Älskar du den här podden? Stötta den genom IKAs nya supporterfunktion. Det är helt upp till dig hur mycket du vill bidra med och det finns ingen bindningstid. Klicka på länken i poddbeskrivningen för att visa din uppskattning och stötta podden.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Just to stick with the någonting om aktier instead of something about stocks, but hope you understand what podcast you're listening to. Anyway, very welcome, and I'm just going to do a quick introduction since we decided to split the episode with David Wu into two. It's just going to be a quick recap, and then we're going to go right into all the good, juicy things David Wu has to say. Perfect. First off, Sandvik, the Swedish company producing mining equipment, had another stable quarter, and that's always something you want to see. And they see no tendency of a bad economic future, but we'll see how that pans out. The stock was almost traded up 5% this last Friday, and the same could be said, or the same can't be said about Ericsson. It was the stock reacted 5% down, so they went two different paths. And what's worth mentioning about Ericsson is that they had a settlement with Apple, which is profitable for the company, but the Iraq bribery that panned out some time ago back is that they wrote off some money to cover the fines that they most likely will receive for the bribery charges. Also worth mentioning is MAG Interactive, the game developer. I know it from producing Quizkampen or also Quizduel, but they also do develop different word type games. Let's say it was a disappointing quarter, at least that's what the markets thought. The stock traded down 20% after their quarterly report last Wednesday, the 19th. And worth mentioning there is that the revenue grew a quite considerable amount, but wasn't really up to par. Meanwhile, the profitability was down significantly. They spent a lot on user acquisitions, which should have maybe panned out in even larger revenue growth. But as we can see, the cash flow and the company spendings has taken a toll on the profitability. But nevertheless, it's a big Twitter case. And also, before we jump into it, I'll just put a little quick disclaimer. Remember that everything that's said and mentioned in this podcast shouldn't be viewed as financial advice. And remember to always depend on your own and continue on your own analysis. Perfect. And we'll jump right into the interview with David Wu.
2023 has had a very interesting start of this year. We've seen rates going down. Stock market has been mainly upwards going, at least in Sweden. How do you see the current market situation? What do you think is going to be the key play here in 2023, David?
Yeah, Tim, you know what? You know, usually January is about the so-called January trades, right? Because at the end of the year, the previous year, you know, the big banks put out their big, you know, year-ahead reports. And essentially, what the market does is to follow the script. So from that point of view, January very often is about the type of investments that investors will like to basically get into, position for the entire year. So generally speaking, by the way, it's interesting because, you know, even though everybody talks about long-term investing, the truth is people are fairly short-term. And at the end of the day, you know what? And so from that point of view, people don't want to basically miss the January trades because normally January trades always invariably blow up by basically February. So people want to get in on the January story. But what is interesting about what's happening in this January is so contrasting to what we went through last year. Believe it or not, to me, the most telling part of the global market is what the U.S. one-year inflation swap is trading at. So inflation swap is basically, you know, interest rate swap, but linked to inflation, okay? And it gives you the most precise measure of market's inflation expectation. So if we look at the one-year inflation swap, it tells you what the market thinks inflation is going to be in the U.S. in a year from now. And guess what? That baby right now is trading just at 2%.
It's pretty amazing. Only 2%? Yes.
Only
2%. That's crazy low, no? Okay. That seems unbelievable almost.
And that's not even headline inflation. I mean, that's not even core inflation we're talking about. That's headline inflation, right? So headline inflation in the U.S. is 6.5% right now. The market is basically expecting, market right now is expecting inflation to collapse. Okay. Mm. And so from that point of view, like you say, well, how is that even possible? Like, you know, and then it's interesting, what does that mean? So the market think, it doesn't really matter what I think, but right now the market is trading with so much conviction about inflation going down to 2%. The fact that inflation break even is trading at 2% tells you the market is not even building any kind of uncertainty premium. Okay. You know, just tells you how confident the market is in this forecast 2%. Okay. Now, this is also the reason why the market is absolutely convinced there's no need for the Fed to actually take rates above 5%. Okay. Hmm. Which is what the Fed has been telling us. And the market definitely does not think the Fed will have to basically keep rates at 5% for very long because right now the market is already pricing in cuts. Okay. In the second half of the year. So you said, well, how is that possible? Inflation is going to be at 2% and then the Fed is going to be cutting rates already. The only possible way for this to be true, of course, is if the U.S. goes into a recession, right? Hmm. And I'm not saying, you know, there are people out there who are talking about recession and so on and so forth. But if the bond market is convinced that a recession is around the corner, it forgot to tell the stock market. Because year to date, okay, if you look at the cyclically sensitive sectors, like basically consumer discretionary, like industrials, they've done actually pretty well. Okay.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, like, so therefore, I think, if you think about market in a holistic sense, I don't think the market is pricing in a recession. What the market is pricing is a soft landing, okay? The market thinks that inflation is going to come down quickly, which means the Fed won't have to be so aggressively hiking rates. As a result, the economy is going to basically get some relief, okay, basically going into the second half of the year. That's why the cyclical is doing well. And then to the
But is even a soft landing possible?
Well, that's it. Well, we're gonna come to this. Why soft landing? To me, is completely ridiculous. But the point here is that's what the market is basically building up right now, right? I mean, it's actually interesting because yesterday's CPI number in the U.S. it came in exactly in line with expectation, okay? And yet rates went down 10 basis points, 10-year rates, and the stock market went up some more. I mean, it's shocking, in fact, because if you look at the CPI number yesterday, if you look at the breakdown, in fact, no surprise there that, you know, CPI for goods, manufactured goods, okay, continues to decline for all the reasons I've been talking about for some time. But the most important measure, which is the core services component, which is what the Federal Reserve pays most attention to, actually went up last month. okay, relative to the month before. Okay, it's actually at the highest level, I don't know since when. And that is generally, you know, because core services is important because 70% of core inflation is core services. 70%. And core services inflation, generally speaking, you know, basically is correlated with wage growth because labor cost is such an important part of the service, basically, industry.
Could you explain exactly what's in the core services? Is it like hospital as well or like education?
I mean, it's just healthcare. It's, you know, it's all that kind of stuff, right? Transportation, healthcare, you know, you know, housing, you know, basically anything that you consume that's not a good rather, you know, rather than services. And so because, I mean, in industrial economies, including Sweden, basically, believe it or not, like manufactured, you know, the share of manufactured goods in your basket, in other words, in your consumption basket, is very small. It's probably like less than 15%, by the way. Okay. Mm. And so from that point of view, it's services that really drive, you know, the overall inflation, therefore drives inflation, basically monetary policy. But my point to you is that it's incredible that the market is trying to, you know, convince itself that inflation was yesterday's story. In fact, even was interesting because last week already we had a weaker than expected German CPI number that got the market really super excited. Even European bond markets staged a massive rally, which propelled, you know, basically a Euro Stoxx 50 basically higher last week. That was a big story last week. Euro Stoxx was the best performing stock market last week, the Eurozone stock market. Yeah. And that generally had to do with German inflation coming in lower than expected. But if you actually look at the detail, the only reason why German CPI came in lower than expected was because German government provided a huge one-off subsidies for energy use in December. And that drove down energy prices. That's the way they calculated. and a more important measure for the ECB, which is the core CPI in Germany, actually went up again. And then yet, you know, it's interesting when you read the financial media, not a single person going to mention that. Yet I know Christine Lagarde is going to care a lot more about core service, core inflation, than she cares about headline inflation. So my, just telling you is that right now, it's like, you know, like the market wants to believe a soft landing, and that's all people are talking about. And basically the financial press is basically joining the party. The banks, that's because they know that's what people want to basically hear. They're basically goading them on. And it's actually fascinating because this is why, you know, January trades invariably always blow up in basically February. But I think this assumption that we're going to get a soft landing is so basically preposterous. I don't even know how to begin. But we can talk about that in a second.
Also, isn't like the whole idea of getting a soft landing, is that not also like contradictory to what the Fed is trying to achieve? Like when people expect things to not be so bad, then it's like a counterweight to the Fed's actual rate hiking.
No, the market is basically saying that inflation is going to come down, you know, mainly because of, you know, what the Fed has already done in terms of monetary tightening. Okay. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the tightening over the past year, you know, basically is already having a major effect at, you know, slowing the economy and driving down inflation. And as a result, the Fed won't have to do much more. That's the way the market is looking at this. But I personally think it's the wrong way of looking at this because I think, you know, the point here is this, you know, despite the Fed tightening over the past year, the reality is that the last 6 months, financial conditions worldwide have eased dramatically. And we know that ultimately monetary policy has an impact on the economy primarily through financial conditions. Okay. And if you look at financial conditions, you know, stock markets are higher, bond yields are lower, mortgage rates are lower, the dollar is weaker, all these things. So from that point of view, the fact is that the market has been fighting the Fed in the last 6 months and has been offsetting the tightening that should have happened, okay, you know, 2022, but it never did. This is the reason why the economy is not slowing, okay? If you actually look at the job growth, I mean, last week, for example, you know, job growth is still running at about 250,000 basically a month. And then with unemployment rate at 3.5%, are you kidding me?
It's really low.
That means really that low. The strong wage growth is not going to be decelerating. And then right now, with all the reshoring from China, you know, last year was a record year for reshoring. 350,000 jobs came back from China. And this is set to continue this year, and it's going to accelerate in Europe, by the way. what this means that, you know what, certainly the very tight labor market cannot meet, okay, the need for skilled labor, or any labor for that matter, as jobs basically come home. And as a result, that is exacerbating, okay, the tightness of the labor market, which means the central banks will probably have to overshoot. Yeah. Now, so I think, you know, from that point of view, like, the issue here is not that whether inflation is going to come down. The issue here is whether it's going to go back to 2%, right? And this is true for the Riksbank, for the Fed, for the ECB, and so on and so forth. I mean, these guys are not going to allow, they're not going to take their foot off the brake until, like, inflation gets back to 2%. You know, and this is what people don't realize. It doesn't matter if it goes from 9% to 7%. We're still very, very far away from getting back to 2%. And to me, there is, like, especially in Europe, you know, like, I think even, like, you know, the ECB is belatedly recognizing that the longer inflation stays at 7, 8, 9, 10%, okay, the greater is going to be the so-called second effect, second round effects associated with inflation, right? What are second round effects, right? Inflation goes up, and then workers say, you know what, it stayed at, you know, double digit for too long, we want higher wages, right? So you see industrial actions, you know, basically, and then, and that's how second round, that's how you get a wage price spiral. And I think we're seeing that already in Europe, obviously. And this is, in fact, the single biggest concern for the ECB.
Not in Sweden, though.
So the point here, this is, they're absolutely not in Sweden yet, but the point here is that the higher inflation stays high, the greater is going to be the risk of second round effect. That's why central banks have to crack down quickly, okay, without allowing the second round effect to basically take off.
There was a state union party in Germany that managed to raise wages. I don't remember which industry, with 10% across the board.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know the IF Metall had high expectations as well. But in Sweden, like, the unions have barely, like, tried to get, like, these high wages. They like, wanted, like, 4% or something. Which is, like, good for the economy, I suppose. But at the same time, they're supposed to represent their workers. So it's, like, a weird paradox.
I think they just hired the wrong negotiator, to be honest.
maybe.
The US are giving Well, just yesterday, you know, there was a strike ended for nurses. These are this like something like 10,000 nurses for the hospitals in New York City. They got away with a 19% wage increase.
19%. What? That's a big increase.
And healthcare,
they also do some heavy lifting.
The biggest sector, and healthcare is the basically the second biggest weight in core services inflation after
healthcare. Oh yeah, right. Oh wow. Yeah, didn't some of the Fed like speakers, what do you call them, the chairman? Didn't some of them go out recently and say that we want to get close to 6%?
I know. I think they're gonna go to 6%. I don't know. I haven't heard that, but definitely they want to go above 5.5, and basically keep it at 5.5 for a while. And I think what the Fed right now is having a heart attack, because, like, it's ironic because, you know, they're, you know, like, they don't think inflation is going to come down that quickly. Obviously, they don't think the inflation is going to be at down at 2% by the end of next year, this year, as the market's currently pricing. So therefore, they think that the market, by pricing in cuts, by driving the stock market, is actually, you know, being counterproductive for what they're trying to do. And they're worried. I mean, they're worried that what this means is that they might have to keep going. They might have to hike rates even more than they want to. You know, because the market somehow is too stupid to realize that inflation is not going to come down so quickly. So it's ironic. Like, you know, what does, I mean, I'm sure, like, you know, like, you know, Jerome Powell is sitting there thinking, like, God, what does the market know that my team of 1,000 economists do not? You know? Has the market gone insane? You know?
True. And how do you think we can profit from this in any ways?
Well, I think,
especially
first of all,
as retail traders.
I think, first of all, I think, you know, first of all, you have to realize something, right? You know, like, in my view, the only way for the soft landing scenario to materialize, okay, is if energy prices continue to fall, okay? Yeah. Now, by the way, you know, to a great extent, in the case of Europe, the reason why Europe hasn't gone into a recession, okay, already, is because, of course, the moderation of energy price, whether it's because of the weather or whatever it is. So I think from that point of view, the outlook for energy price is going to be very important. I mean, to the extent that, you know, it will determine whether we can go into a soft landing or not. So from that point of view, already we're sitting here talking about something very important, which is like, well, you know, listen, if you want to have the markets pricing in a soft landing, the only way you're going to make money is by betting against the market. And the only way that the market is going to be wrong, well, the easiest way for the market to be wrong is if energy prices turn out to be higher than expected. So the question then, you say, well, you know, is that possible? What's going to drive energy prices higher? Now, in my view, there are two major factors that are going to drive energy prices higher. Number one, the reopening in China. Now, I think what people need to realize, okay, is that China is not only the second largest consumer of energy in the world. China is now the largest, basically, car market in the world. Just to give you a sense, like, because Volvo now is owned by the Chinese, right? Like, China last year sold 25 million cars, okay? China, the U.S., which is the second largest, sold 15 million cars. The third largest country in terms of car sales is Japan and India. They sold last year 4 million cars, right? So China is like off the chart.
Huge
right? So
difference.
This is what we're talking about, right?
Huge.
Last year, because of the lockdown in China, because Chinese growth collapsed, Chinese basically oil consumption collapsed, right? I mean, basically. Okay. So right now, what's going on, what people need to realize is this. I mean, again, and I talked about this last time, which is that China's doing what Sweden did in 2020, right? Which is, you know, what embracing herd immunity. Okay. It's actually very funny that a country, you know, Sweden and China are the only two countries in the whole world that have gone down this path. And China's gone to even more insane, at a more insane speed, because they're not even, like, Sweden at least tried to basically, like, keep the elderly out of harm's way. Like, I don't think that China's even trying to do that. Partly because I think the Chinese don't take, you know, Omicron that seriously. They're thinking, like, this is just, you know, this is just basically a sort
maybe
of
maybe it's also good for their aging want. Population.
If perhaps. Maybe they want to kill off some of the aging population. But the point here is that, in my view, okay, this is going to be record speed in terms of the time it will take for China to reach herd immunity, right? Herd immunity is defined as, let's just call it 70% of the population gets infected. I think we are literally 2 weeks away from herd immunity, by the way, if we're not there already. By the way, 2 weeks away is very important because Chinese New Year starts on February 22nd. Okay.
Yeah.
And my view is that
it's going to be a big COVID fest, probably.
I think there'll be a huge celebration or whatever it is. But the point here is, once you get to 70%, then you know what, you're home free, as you know. Because once you are 70%, then elderly people are going to be protected, because like then it won't be able to spread because everybody's already been infected, right? So my point here is, and it doesn't matter because the Chinese, you know, life's so cheap in China. So, you know, for them to kill off a million or two people, probably that's just a big deal, because you have to understand the Chinese, and this is not a criticism because I'm Chinese, you have to realize, like, you know, China in 4,000 years of history, okay, actually always basically give priority to the majority. As long as the majority is going to be better off, they have no problem sacrificing a few million people here, a few million people there, as long as it's in the benefit of basically the majority. So from that point, you can think of this as being very socialist, by the way, okay? So the point here is that, therefore, they think that the economy was doing so poorly, they had no choice but to open up, and they wanted, if they're going to open up, they're going to open up very quickly, so as to basically put it behind them as quickly as possible, and then even if it means that some people are going to die, so be it. So they've accepted that reality, okay? And my point here is that literally in 2-3 weeks' time, like, China is going to be back to normal. Because literally, when you reach herd immunity, that's it. Okay.
Yeah.
That's it. It's as though the whole country's got vaccinated and now basically is immune. And I think, you know, you're going to see explosive growth. I mean, there is no question about it. I mean, every Chinese is going to want to get on the plane to go somewhere. You know, they're probably going to go on vacation to Thailand, by the way, because right now, like, a lot of countries are making it difficult for the Chinese tourists to go visit. They need to have a PCR test, whatever it is. But Thailand just actually dropped that requirement. So from that point of view, I think you're going to see mass, basically, tourism pouring into Thailand. So, I mean, that's pretty bullish for the Southeast Asian economy in general, by the way. I think clearly, you know, you're going to probably see, you know, a strong increase in car sales. Okay. That probably should basically benefit Tesla, by the way, because Tesla clearly has been struggling mainly because of the slowdown in car sales in China, which is their biggest market. Now, but mainly, I think this is going to be very bullish for oil price. Okay.
Oil price.
And commodity prices in general. Right.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I copper think, you know, or tin or something.
Copper, you know, basically nickel, iron ore, you name it. Okay. The point here is that I think, you know, we have to remember China accounts for 40% of the world's consumption of base metals, like iron ore and copper, right? And again, it's the second largest consumer of energy. By the way, just this week, the Chinese government had just issued a huge quota for oil import. Because like the Chinese government understands that, you know, basically, you know, oil demand is going to go through the roof. So my view is that oil price has been going up finally a little bit, but I still think it's the upside. And by the way, I think the important thing to understand is this. China recovery, okay, is going to be reflationary for the whole world. And that is going to complicate monetary tightening among the developed countries to the extent that it's going to basically keep inflation higher for longer. And as a result, basically delay any potential pivot from this hiking cycle. So from that point of view, I think China basically doing better should be viewed as a negative, okay, rather than as a positive in the past by basically at least the European and the US economy.
Yeah.
Okay. This is something very, very important to understand.
What are the Chinese oil import levels like today before the big resurge?
So, for example, right now, last year, they imported about 12 million barrels per day. Yeah. I think this year is probably going to go up to about 14. Okay, easily.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so, it's
so we're 2 talking million about barrels. A 2 million barrels per day, there's no supply. There's no there's no spare capacity in the world for 2 million, except in Russia.
Yeah. Okay. That's where the dark and tankers come in.
Right. So basically, so that's one part of the thing, which is that I think that China recovery is bullish for energy, and that is bad news for this soft landing scenario. Now, the other basically big, I think, negative, or rather positive for energy price, is that I believe that Russia is about to launch a major offensive in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that is why.
Yeah, and I think, you know, from that point of view, I think this is also the reason why I'm bearish the euro. I'm short the euro because there's no doubt, if Russia were to really stage a major offensive, you know, that's going to force the U.S. and the Europeans to enforce sanctions, okay, on the existing sanctions on Russian oil export, and oil price is going to go through the roof, okay? And that would be bad for Europe, bad for the euro, bad for European assets, and obviously very bullish for energy. So I'm very much of that view that I think the reason why the market still doesn't get it is because there's too much goddamn propaganda going on. Okay. People really don't, I think the average Joe has no idea what really is going on in the battlefield. I think the Ukrainians are getting absolutely decimated. Ukraine since 2014 has been building this, a Ukrainian Maginot line. Okay. Yeah. All the ones from Soledar down to Bakhmut, down to Avdiivka, down to Marinka. Okay. That line of defense, okay, they pour concrete. There are salt mines. They're literally it's mined all over. It's heavily defended. Okay. And you have to realize this is the reason why it's taking longer, okay, for the Russians to break through that line of defense. But as you probably know, you know, Soledar has now finally been taken over by the Russians, if not all of it, certainly most of it. And they're literally 3 kilometers outside Bakhmut. I mean, Bakhmut looks like it's going to be fallen very soon. Marinka looks like it's going to fall very soon. And what you need to know, the reason why, okay, Zelensky is sending enforcement after enforcement to Bakhmut to protect this line, is because if this line were to break, and when it does, there is no fallback position for the Ukrainians. To the extent you're talking about just like American-style prairie, okay, it's not easily defensible, which will give Russian, basically, aircraft a huge, basically, advantage. It will basically make Ukrainian, basically, like troops on the ground, like shooting targets.
Yeah.
Okay. And the situation's gotten so urgent. This is the reason why all of a sudden, you know, the Germans say, oh, we'll send you some basically mortar, basically APCs. The Americans talking about Bradley, the French basically the MDX. Okay. But literally, this is much too late. Okay. The point here is this. Like, you know, they're all waking up to this reality much too late, because the reality is this. Like, in the fog of war, you never really know. And I think the problem with the West is that it's convinced itself that Russia was being beaten, that Russia was basically on its last knees, and so on and so forth. And I think the Russians probably want you to believe that, partly. Because if you are preparing for a major offensive, probably you want to basically play along with that. Let your enemy underestimate you. The only basically person who has not underestimated the Russians is basically General Zelensky, who is the, you know, commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian forces. You should read, I mean, your listeners should basically get a hold of The Economist magazine 2 weeks ago and read the interview that Zelensky did. He, I mean, listen, the Ukrainians until now have been trying to talk big, right? And like, you know, you talk with basically Zelensky. I can't believe this man. Zelensky actually went to the Golden Globe. I mean, his people in his country are dying by the thousand. He goes to the Golden Globe and he's telling them that we're winning. Okay. But if you actually listen to what Zelensky said, he's painting an actually rather depressing picture. He thinks Russia is about to launch a major offensive. You know, so he shares my view. And he says, we just haven't got the equipment or the manpower to basically defend ourselves against the next offensive. And so from that point of view, what I'm saying is, I think this is going to come. And certainly, you know, because of the unseasonably warm weather in December, this is the reason why it took a longer than expected, because, you know, the Russians wanted to wait until the ground is frozen over, okay? Because, you know, only then, you know, it will give their tanks, their basically mechanized units, basically a clear advantage in this kind of basically winter battle. And guess what? Now, if you look at the average temperature in eastern Ukraine, it's about minus 10. You know, it's been 2 weeks like this. Ground is frozen over. I think the Russians are going to go. I mean, I think very soon. I cannot tell you it's going to be tomorrow, next day after that. But I assume it's going to be the next 2 or 3 weeks. Okay. So my view is that, you know, right now, it's very simple, right? So if I'm right about China, right, higher energy price. If I'm right about basically Russia, higher energy price. So from that point of view, I only need to be right about, I mean, I don't even have to be right about both. It'd be great if I'm right about both. If I'm just right about one, I think that's pretty bullish for oil. Okay. Hmm. By the way, I don't like buying energy stocks because energy stocks are very expensive. Hmm. Okay. But oil price is not so expensive. Okay. But then again,
you have to trade futures.
You have to basically buy futures. I like the June 2023 Brent futures, which I like. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, right now it's trading around 84. I think this baby can go to 100. Okay, easily. Now, however, I'm also hedging my bets. Like, I'm also basically, I said, well, you know, however, like, if I'm right about this, this is not good for the U.S. stock market. This might just basically throw the U.S., the global economy into a recession. And in a recession, oil price is going to be lower. So I've also shorted some S&P, you know, 500, basically, June futures against my long oil future, right?
As a hedge,
because it then becomes a relative value trade, right? It's basically saying that China doing better and Russia attacking is not good for the West, okay? It's not good for the stock market. So you basically sell. So that's the way I'm positioned, and I'm sure Europe on top of that, right?
Yeah, so, the euro is because super I don't strong think the right Europeans, now.
Yeah, especially given the fact everybody and the grandmother is loaning the euro right now. Right. I mean, this is also very important. You don't want to basically join the crowded trade. The beauty of being selling the euro right here is the fact that everybody thinks the U.S. is going to reach, you know, soft landing, so the Fed is going to stop hiking rates. Meanwhile, the ECB is now under pressure to keep going. Because the ECB started hiking rates later than the Fed, therefore, now that the Fed is going to be stopping soon, the market believes the ECB is going to go on, so the interest rate differential is going to move in favor of the euro. This is why everybody and their grandmothers loan the euro. But my point is that in the event of war, you think, you know, in the stock market tanking, you think the ECB is going to be hiking rates at all? So no. I think this is what I'm talking about. It's like, you know, in fact, if anything, in that kind of scenario, Europe is going to be damned. Is going to basically literally will be facing the worst of stagflation, including Sweden. So I think from that point of view, again, this is what we're talking about here. So this is why, you know, and it's not just about politics, it's about politics, economics, about the market consensus. What could the market be wrong? So it's, you know, so you can see, you know, investing is not that easy. But because today, increasingly, you guys keep talking about Sweden as though like Sweden is like a separate planet. Sweden is not a separate planet. Sweden is very much part of the global economy. And then, unfortunately, if you don't understand what's happening to the global economy, you have no business investing in Swedish stocks, especially given Swedish companies have a very global business model.
And yeah, very export-reliant.
Except for basically Swedish banks, most Swedish companies that are publicly traded, most of their business is outside Sweden, by the way. So I think this is something very important. Like Sweden, for example, like, you know, where it gets interesting is manufacturing, right? Sweden was losing out. Like, you know, like if you look at Ericsson, not even so much Ericsson, what's it called? Electrolux, right? Yeah. Electrolux is a good example. Electrolux has been, you know, I mean, very little of the Electrolux manufacturing is still happening in Sweden. So they've been outsourcing.
No.
Yeah. Okay? To basically Eastern Europe.
They also gave a profit warning like 2 days ago, I think.
Exactly. Right? Because most of their business, most of their sales is in Europe. Right? And clearly Europe, okay, I think it's going to be a big problem. Okay? If I'm right about basically this. The next phase of this basically war going on. And I think, you know, also it has to do with the fact that, you know, it's become very expensive for European manufacturers. You know, especially manufacturers now in Europe are now under pressure to basically reshore their jobs away from China and then all sorts of kind of things, which is actually making things more expensive. Just think about this. I mean, German industries are now talking about deindustrialization of Germany, you know, as a result of very, very high energy prices. It's not even so much in absolute terms. That would be less of a problem than the fact that in relative terms, European manufacturers are paying much higher, you know, basically energy prices than their counterparts in China and the United States, or even in Asia for that matter. And that clearly is going to have a big negative effect on basically Sweden.
Yeah.
Because Sweden still has a fairly large manufacturing base for a European economy, for example. Okay. And by the way, if I think about OMX, right, generally speaking, people think about OMX as being very cyclical, seems to be very, very, you know, pro-cyclical as opposed to counter-cyclical. Meaning that, generally speaking, when you go into a beginning of a global recovery, right, Sweden tends to outperform, okay? Stocky tends to outperform, by the way, also, because people tend to basically buy Swedish stocks at the start of a recovery, because if you look at the Swedish economy, it tends to basically lead the European economy as opposed to lag the European economy. So from that point of view, like, if we are indeed going into a recession, a slowdown, whatever, I think OMX definitely is not where I'm going to be parking my money. So from that point of view, like, you know, for your investors, what you need to understand is, like, it doesn't really matter how well you know a particular company, you think this company is cheap, whatever. You have to know, I mean, how does this basic company fit into the global economic cycle? And where is the global economic cycle? And what are the forces that are going to be driving the global economic cycle? And then you can talk about, once you figure all that out, maybe you can talk about whether you think this particular Swedish company is attractive or not.
Okay. Yeah. What do you think about companies that use the energy problem right now as a key part of the business model? So I mean, like companies that provide like solar services or like solar panels, batteries or battle panels, heat pumps, because we need to take out the gas, basically, right?
So let's talk about that for a second. So last year, if you look at, you know, obviously, like, you know, since 2020, everybody's talking about thematic investing, you know, clean energy and so on and so forth. Last year, okay, if you look at the various ETFs, okay, ETFs that are linked to wind energy was down 30%. Okay. ETFs that were linked to green hydrogen was down 60%. You know, ETFs linked to lithium battery was down 30%. So solar did better. Solar just basically broke even. Yeah. Okay. But what you need to realize is that the fact that, you know, listen, I mean, there are no obvious investments because everybody's been talking about clean energy. So for your little, basically, for your 25-year-old guy in Sweden, you know, who's investing on the sideline, like, you know, he's not going to know any more about what's going on than, let's say, the big guys who are, you know, AP3, AP4, AP1, you know, or for that matter, yeah, basically the big hedge funds, big mutual funds in the world, like, you know, who are really driving the market, right? Mm. I think the important thing, but I can give you an angle here, which is, I think, important. So what I'm telling you is that, you know, it's tough. I mean, clean energy sounds great, but it hasn't been a profitable business. And it hasn't been a profitable business for lots of different reasons, okay? Not least of all because the technology itself is not quite mature. As you know about this green hydrogen business, there are now increasing concerns about leaks. Okay, and actually that's become a major concern, by the way. Green hydrogen sounds like an amazing story, yeah, but if there are leaks, it might do more environmental damage than actually basically fossil fuel. So this has become a major problem. So until they fix this problem, you know, the commercial viability of the entire sector remains in basically a big question mark. But there's one good story for clean energy story for Europe this year, and I'll tell you what it is. Okay.
Go.
Last year, as you know, Biden, okay, basically managed to get past, okay, this very green energy basically bill with hundreds of billion dollars. Okay. And all that money is going to subsidies, right? Basically, it's like going to subsidies mainly to help US companies to fight off competition.
It's been criticized in Europe, actually.
Exactly. Okay, so basically China, because you understand, the Chinese are now way ahead of everybody else when it comes to clean energy, right? I mean, they're like, you know, when it comes to electric vehicles, China's the biggest market, solar, they already dominate, and they're ahead, even in hydrogen, by the way, okay? In lithium batteries, they're the biggest after Tesla, okay? So the Americans want to, you know, basically play catch up, okay, to the Chinese. They don't want the Chinese to dominate this entire sector, which obviously is going to be the future of the world, by the way. So what the Americans did was that they, you know, essentially adopted an industrial policy, which of course is a big no-no, okay, basically for modern capitalist economy to direct, okay, money into specific industries. That is anti-competitive. But they did it anyway, because that's how much they hate the Chinese these days. Now the Europeans are saying, shit, like, you can't do this, because by doing this, you're putting us at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
By the way, it's not like the Americans give a damn about the Europeans, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Had they given a damn about the Europeans, they would not have basically blown up, you know, Nord Stream 2, by the way. I have no doubt it was blown up by Nord Stream. You know, the Americans blew it up.
Really?
The Americans don't give a damn about Europe. By the way, Tim, if you remember, I talked about this in my class, that the Americans blew up Nord Stream 2. And guess what? Just 2 weeks ago, The Washington Post just ran a huge article. You should read this yourself. 2 weeks ago, Washington Post ran a huge article saying that after having interviewed 25 officials in 7-8 different countries, I imagine including Sweden, they said there's no evidence that Russia blew up Nord Stream 2. Okay.
Russia.
And I said this from the very beginning. It was not the Russians, it's the Americans, because the Americans are the only ones with an incentive to blow up Nord Stream 2. And the reason why they wanted to do it is because they don't want to give the Germans any reason to negotiate with Moscow. It's simple as that. Because once you blow up Nord Stream 2, you know what? There's nothing for the Germans, not going to get anything No. By negotiating with the Russians.
No.
Okay?
Exactly.
And this is also why your own Navy, the Swedes, after many weeks of investigation, came out and said they think they know who did it, but they cannot go public with the name because they said that will violate, that will compromise the national security. You know, you think the Swedes, if the Swedes actually thought that the Russians blew up Nord Stream 2, they will hide it because it somehow doesn't serve their national security purpose? Give me a goddamn break. Okay.
No.
So my point here is that the Europeans, the most important thing was that Scholz yesterday, German Chancellor Scholz, yesterday came out saying that he is now putting his support behind the push in Europe to come up with his own industrial policy vis-a-vis green energy. Okay. And that is very bullish for European green energy. Okay. Yeah. Obviously, it's not bullish for, you know, basically, it just means that, you know, by the way, what that means is that Europe will have to go into even more debts, right? Because you're talking about more subsidies, which means right now all these governments are running big deficit. They'll have to basically run up even bigger deficit, okay, take on more debts in order to subsidize basically their own green energy industry so that they can compete with the Americans. The total thing is absolutely insane. But you know what? Some people are going to make some money from this.
Yeah.
So this is actually a time to actually start looking at European companies that will benefit from a massive increase in subsidies in Europe that basically go into European companies.
Mm. Do you think the global debt levels is going to become a problem?
That's already a big problem. Right? Yeah. I mean, let me just give you a sense. Like, if you look, I mean, obviously, it's less of a problem in Sweden and Norway because you guys
we have low debts
in a very, very good shape. But that's uniquely Scandinavian thing, okay? If you look at the U.S., for example, right? I mean, the issuer of the world's reserve currency. You know, U.S. public debt to GDP ratio has now jumped to 95%, okay? If you just look at the narrow definition of debt, which is debt held by the public, basically a wider definition will put it closer to 130% of GDP. But most importantly, let me give you one number, okay? As a result of, you know, rising interest rates, the interest cost to servicing, you know, basically U.S. debt, government debt, has obviously gone up a lot. In the third quarter of last year, and it would have gone even higher in the fourth quarter, in the third quarter of last year, interest payments, okay, on servicing U.S. federal debt was $738 billion annualized rate.
You know, that's such a big number.
Just give you a sense. $738 billion. You know what that means? That means the U.S. government is now spending more on paying interest on its debt than it spends on education. Do you know that $738 billion, is more than the combined spending on research and development by both the private and the public sectors in the United States? That's what we're talking about here. So basically, you know, this is why this inflation, is going to be a double whammy. Because basically, you know, for a long time, governments can basically like spend money like there's no tomorrow because they were funding their debt at zero interest rates and Europe at negative rates. But now that, you know, inflation is high, interest rates are higher, like every dollar you're borrowing, you have to now think about like the interest you're going to pay on this. And the more you're going to be paying interest, the less you're going to have basically money in terms of funding other priorities like health, like education, or even defense for that matter. So now imagine you're in Europe right now, right? The German government's gone from borrowing a negative rate to now a positive rate, right? Now they say they want to increase defense spending, right? They want to increase basically spending on green energy. And then the whole economy is now in general spending much more on energy than prior to the war because they don't want to use German basically cheap oil and cheap gas. Just think about that. I mean, if this is not going to undo Europe, if that's not bearish for the euro, I don't know what is bearish for the euro. That's why what people don't realize is that Europeans are committing a total economic suicide by following the U.S. down this rabbit hole where they're trying to basically get rid of Putin. For me, just the total thing, one day somebody's going to write about it, the stupidity of it all.
Maybe afterwards.
That's going to be a great read. Yeah. But I mean, some definitely interesting takes. And,
very interesting. I feel often that like the political analysis of like when you're researching companies and stocks is very overlooked by most investors. Like how would you conduct like political analysis or like viewing the political landscape of your sector or company that you're interested in?
The first thing you need to do, you got to basically like follow the general news, right? So we know that Schultz was in D.C., right? If you were following the news closely enough, you would know that Olaf Scholz was in Washington, D.C. You know that Scholz brought up the issue of the American subsidies with Biden, but Biden basically said, go fuck yourself, okay? Macron did the same thing, and Biden said, you know, stop it, okay? So you know that the Europeans did go to the American friends and said, you got to change this because your policy is putting us at a disadvantage. Their American friends basically said, you know what? Forget it. Okay. We're not going to change. So therefore, now momentum is rising in Europe. Okay. That basically, we have to basically match this. So now, again, in order to get this, you have to know, okay, fine. Macron was the first one who brought this up with basically Biden. Biden basically stonewalled him. And then Scholz did it again. And then, so, you know, there's a whole evolution. There's a whole process, you know, and therefore you have to watch the news every day because like, unless you actually are following the news every day, like there's no way you can put one and one together and say, oh, wow, there is a continuous timeline here because usually there is a continuous, sequence of events that usually leads to a certain action being taken. So that's very important. So, for example, the most successful hedge fund, that ever came out of Sweden was Nectar. You've heard of Nectar, right?
Yeah.
So Nectar was a hedge fund. I think they closed down. Now it would become a family office. But in the 2000s, like Nectar, I think, was managing north of $7 billion. They were one of the best, basically, like hedge funds in Europe, by the way, outside London. And they had a very global, basically, orientation. Sure, they took some risk in Sweden because a couple of these guys came out of the Riksbank, said they knew the Swedish economy very well. So they were able to basically, make smart bets in Sweden. But generally speaking, they had a very good read about what was happening in Europe, what's happening in the U.S. Back then, nobody really cared about China so much. Maybe China was not exactly on their radar. But in general, like I remember, like, you know, at the time I was working at Barclays and later on Bank of America, I would go to Stockholm like four times a year to visit the guys at Nectar who were trading around the world. What I'm saying is like we talked about everything except for Sweden. Because for them, like, you know, the playing field was really the global markets. They felt that they had an advantage Sweden only after they've understood what's happening in terms of the global, basically, environment. And I think if that was the case 15 years ago, today it has to be like doubly true. So this is even just at a European level, you have to understand what's going on. Okay. Because politics is what drives policies. And policies is what drives economics and markets, and economics drives markets. So you have to go all the way back. So you have to understand how this politics drive policies.
My final question was, do you have any concrete news sources that you would recommend that you use or, if you want to follow the macro?
Listen, honestly, I read very widely. So like at a minimum, I mean, again, you know, I mean, listen, I mean, I don't know if people are going to be able to do this, but you should read I read the Wall Street Journal. I read Bloomberg. Okay. And read Reuters. I mean, that's the minimum, right? If you're going to be involved in the markets. Now, FT is very expensive. So I can understand so I might be recommending FT to you guys.
Wall Street Journal, you can get it for $150. Tip for everyone, FT is free if you're Gothenburg University.
Oh, okay, good.
If someone okay, here good. Is
I think
there.
I think the FT is very it. Good. Yeah. So it. I think obviously FT Wall Street Journal, like the minimum. You basically obviously day to day you gotta read Bloomberg. Not because Bloomberg reporting is that great. It's just because 90% of people in the market, basically, they've got a Bloomberg terminal in front of them. So their view tends to be very colored by Bloomberg reporting. This is one of the reasons why I'm totally against Bloomberg, because Bloomberg literally has a monopoly, okay, on basically content, you know, dissemination these days, okay? And then as a result, like, Bloomberg story can really drive the market, even if the reporting is wrong, okay? But it doesn't really matter. But my favorite, if I'm going to read anything at all, by the way, if I'm just going to read one thing, I know what I would read. I'll read basically Reuters. And the reason why, and it may be, you know, you have to sort of reach my, you know, years of experience to basically just rely on Reuters, because Reuters, for the most part, is just about fact reporting. These yeah. days, honestly, I don't want to read a piece of news that's heavily editorialized.
Okay.
I don't want people to tell me what this basically fact means. I just want to read the facts and basically and inform myself. Because if I have lots of facts, then I'm going to be able to string together the facts and make sense of them myself. Okay. Yeah. So I prefer these very pure basically reporting, the better. Mm. But again, perfect. I read a lot. I read a couple of British newspapers every day, Telegraph and The Guardian. I read a German newspaper at least once a day. You know, I read a French newspaper. I read a Chinese newspaper. Wow. I read a few American. And I read a lot of basically blogs. And, you know, sort of like, I read a lot. But I'm not expecting everybody to be able to have that level of basic, that kind of time, by the way, for that matter. Because no. I do this, I'm still doing this for a living. So basically it's a different thing for me as part of my job. But my point here is that for a would-be investor, I would say that if you want, I would basically, if you're going to read one thing, put yourself on the Reuters alert. By the way, Reuters every day, they put out a basically market opening thing and then a market closing. All this is free. You can just sign up for it and they'll send it to you.
It's good.
And that's very, very important. And then during the course of the day, you know, basically put yourself on the alert if there's like a major policy change, whatever it is, usually comes out very reliable in Reuters. I think the level of journalism is higher in Reuters than AP, or for that matter, basically Bloomberg. Okay. But again, you have to learn, you have to understand what are the major issues of the day so that you know what to read for. Right? Like, you know what? So from that point of view, am I going to read about Greece these days? No, I'm not going to read about Greece these days because I don't think it matters. So what I'm saying is at any given point in time, if you know what's important, then you would just follow the important stories and not waste your time with the less important stories. But to do that, to know what's important, you sort of have to follow the market's narrative. Okay, like what I'm just telling you right now. Like the market right now is cooking up the soft landing scenario. That's important, clearly, right? Mm. Because, like, therefore, the inflation outlook is going to be very important in terms of either reinforcing that scenario or contradicting that, right? I'm telling you that right now, a big story is China. So basically, following China, it's very, very important about the basically perception of how quickly China is going to come out of this, basically, this transitional phase. It's going to be hugely important.
Yeah.
I told you about basically this Russia thing. So basically, obviously, following closely, I followed this, like, you know, I probably spent more time following the Russian war in Ukraine than anything else, because that's very time-consuming, because there's so much goddamn propaganda going on. So you have to read through the noise to get to actually what really is going on and formulating your own view. That's not easy. All these things, you know, and then we said that I think Germany is going to be very, very important, because Scholz right now is not in a good place, okay? He's basically, he wants to basically, this is why, like, it's important. Because Scholz, on one hand, okay, he still views the U.S. as being, you know, the most important ally for Europe. On the other, Scholz also said he wants to see a multipolar world, okay?
Okay. Yeah.
That's what he told the Chinese. So in some sense, Europe is going to move depending how, you know, Germany moves. And how does Germany maneuver itself basically between China and, I think, you know, the U.S.? I think that's going to be a very important thing. And that obviously ultimately will extend to Germany. Mm.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
We have a final segment in the end of our show always, where we do something called Volley of the Week, we call it.
Yeah.
Which is like a quick thing where we try to give a hot take or something that happened recently. But you've been handing us very hot takes, of course,
the whole episode. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. But maybe, Marcus, you want to say something quick? You have...
My vol of the week is that the Swedish house market is down more than I thought it would be. I think I heard that it was down. Yeah. Housing was down, like standalone houses was 3%, and then apartments down 1% in December. That was wrong.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I saw a Bloomberg article on it, and it's like they're actually began to like using Sweden as sort of bad example what's happening with this housing crisis. My short volley is Unibap, which is a smaller Swedish space company, which is like data in space, which recently got a big order for their space cloud, which was, I think it was 62 million euros. And even though the company is not profitable at this point, I think it's a company you should pay attention to it, I think, in the upcoming years.
So, David, what's your volley?
I just want to basically say I'll say that actually I tend to agree with Stefan Ingves, who's come out basically expressing his concern about the Swedish housing market. I do think that the Swedish basically housing debt is much too high now, and from that point of view, like, you know, the market is more overvalued than many other countries, and I think from that point of view, you know, Stegman Invest, who was the guy who actually restructured the Swedish, you know, banking system after the collapse of the Swedish housing market in the early 90s, I think he's got a point. This should be a major point of concern. I think, you know, from that point of view, again, if we go into a recession next year, this is not going to be good news. So I would stay out of anything housing related.
He was in CNBC, right? In an interview.
Yes. Yes, yes.
Maybe it's a tip to look up that as well. I think it's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, really let's volley, wrap this David. Up.
Yep.
I really enjoyed really our good conversation, volley, David.
Yep. We also have to put in a financial disclaimer stating that everything that's been said and mentioned in this podcast should not be interpreted as financial advice. And remember to always do your own analysis and follow your own analysis.
Of course. Great. And David, if someone wants to reach out to you or follow you on social media and your YouTube, whatever, can you give some?
Yeah, so you can check me out on YouTube if you want. I mean, it's David Wu Unbound on YouTube. And if you like, you know, what you get, you can always basically visit me at davidwuunbound.com, which is basically my retail blog, which is a subscription-based blog.
That's really cool.
Great.
Thank you so much, David.
Thank you. And if someone wants to reach out to us, of course, you can visit our Twitter or Instagram at nantingomaktier. And our Gmail is nantingomaktier@gmail.com or is .se. .com.
.com.
Yeah, of course.
It's great. Gmail, bro.
Okay, to all listeners now, I hope you have a good week.
Happy investing. Take care, David.
Yeah.
Take care. Okay, bye.